sugar. Chances are you've already consumed a few teaspoons of sugar today, in your coffee, on your cereal, in that muffin you ate. Sugar is both a simple basic food and a globally traded commodity that has shaped the course of human history, and it's the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. I'm joined by Dr. Jock Galloway, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Geography at the University of Toronto, and author of The Sugar Cane Industry, an Historical Geography from Its Origins to 1914. It's published by Cambridge University Press. And also with us is Dr. Sharon Acabas, Associate Research Scholar and Associate Director of the Columbia University Medical Center Institute of Human Nutrition. Welcome to Please Explain.
Great to be here.
Yes, great to be here.
Well, Dr. Galloway, there are various sources of sweetness in nature. When we talk about sugar, what are we referring to?
We're referring to sucrose, which is produced by two plants. One, the major source, is sugar cane, which is a tropical grass. And also the second source is sugar beet, which is a root crop grown in temperate countries. And both produce sucrose, pure sugar.
So, Dr. Cabas, I'm not exactly sure I understand, because I've heard of sucrose, fructose, glucose. Are they all parts of the same thing?
Well, you're not the only one who doesn't understand. On the USDA website, there are 18 different sources of what we call added sugar. Dr. Galloway, I agree, is correct in saying that technically sugar refers to sucrose, but in many instances it's become synonymous with any added sugar compound. So sucrose is a form of a carbohydrate. It's two what's called monosaccharides linked together, glucose and fructose. And we tend to use all of those terms interchangeably, sucrose, maltose, fructose, lactose, etc. That's where some of the confusion has arisen.
What about other sweeteners like honey, maple syrup, or the fruit juices that are used to sweeten no-sugar fruit preserves?
Yeah, all of those 18 in the body are effectively the same.
So they all have, they're all chemically a combination of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen?
Correct. They're all part of the carbohydrate class. So they're literally a hydrate of carbon. They share the chemical structure of one molecule of water to every carbon that's in the structure.
Dr. Galloway, do we know where the word sugar comes from?
I think it's of possibly Sanskrit origin. You've got me on that one. But I think it Sanskrit is certainly present in Arabic and brought into the Mediterranean at the time of the Muslim expansion around the Mediterranean. The first evidence we have, actually, of the making of sugar from sugar cane is in northern India from Sanskrit records.
So it's reasonable to assume that it's a Sanskrit word.
Yeah.
Why was sugar preferred over honey, for example? Is it because it produces a different kind of sweetness?
Well, yes, in a sense it does. The great advantage of sugar over honey and other sweeteners, such as things like condensed fruit juices, like syrup of figs and things like that, the great advantage of sugar is that it does not flavor what you add it to. Rather, it brings out the flavors of what you add it to. If you add honey to something, it's going to change the taste of what it is you've added it to. Sugar doesn't do that. It's also easily stored, and it also has another virtue. It's a preservative. So there are a number of values in sugar which gave it eventually ascendancy over such things as honey as a sweetener.
It's a preservative, so when we combine it with fruit, for example, in a jam, that keeps the fruit from spoiling?
It does for a certain period of time, anyway.
Yeah, until enough water separates, let's say, from the jam so that the sugar content is low in that part of the jam, and then the microorganisms can grow.
Now, how is sugar harvested and processed, how does sugarcane give us sugar?
Well, sugarcane is rich in a juice, and what you have to do to get sugar is to extract the juice from the sugarcane. You can do this simply by chewing on the cane, if you wish.
And I'm sure that's what people first did.
That's what they first did, and you can trace that back, actually, to the origins of sugarcane, probably in New Guinea. But if you're going to make sugar on a sort of an industrial basis, what you have to do is extract the juice from the sugarcane, and that you can do in a mill. And there's a whole history of various types of mills of increasing efficiency to extract the juice from the cane. You have to do this immediately after harvest, because the cane starts drying out as soon as it is harvested. And, of course, that reduces the yield of the sugar you're going to get from it. So the first step is to extract the juice from the cane. The next step is to separate the sugar content from the juice. You do this by boiling the juice. And so the second stage would be having a series of cauldrons over fires. And you'd start off with the sugar juice being put into the first cauldron and be brought to a boil. And in doing so, various impurities will come to the surface of the boiling juice, which these are then skimmed off. And as the juice, as you begin to evaporate the water, the juice begins to concentrate. You move it to successively smaller cauldrons where the heat is greater. And you reach the stage where it's reduced to a sort of a sugary mass. And you begin to get the separation of crystals from the molasses. At that stage, you take the sugar, you take this sugary mass, and you pour it into, this is a traditional way of doing it, you pour it into upturned terracotta pots with a hole at the bottom. And what happened then, you'd have racks of these. And what happens then is the molasses slowly drains through the hole in the bottom. And after a period of time, you're left, you upturn your terracotta pot, and out pops a sugar loaf, a crystallized sugar loaf. And there you have your sugar. It's not very pure. It's still got a lot of molasses in it, so greater concentrations at the base and at the top, but you have a sugar loaf.
So if you turn it over, you wind up with the white part on top and the brown part on the bottom.
That's right. The thing is, this would then be sent from the tropical world, wherever it is produced. You put it on board ships and send it off to Europe or to North America. And normally it would then be, once it's arrived at refineries in the market country where it's going to consume the sugar, you melt this again. The melting is a technical term. You melt it again in boiling water and go through again a refining, getting rid of more impurities, a similar sort of process that's gone through before, and you end up eventually with a white sugar, white crystal sugar, and this is the final product.
My guest on Please Explain Today, talking about sugar, are Dr. Jacques Galloway of the University of Toronto, author of The Sugar Cane Industry, an Historical Geography from Its Origins to 1914. Also, Dr. Sharon Acabas, who is Associate Director of the Columbia University Medical Center Institute of Human Nutrition. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Dr. Acabas, has white sugar always been the preferred kind? Have some people always preferred brown sugar?
Well, in general, things that are white, white rice, white sugar, tend to be considered superior. In terms of the nutritional value, there's very much is made of the difference in, say, brown sugar and white sugar, but there's very little nutritional value in brown sugar. If you're getting, let's say, if you're counting on iron or something like that from your brown sugar, you have to eat so much brown sugar that you have many more problems than with your iron.
So brown sugar, which is preferred by some people who go to health food stores, really just pretty much the same thing. What about what they sell as raw sugar?
It's pretty much goes the same for all of these, for molasses, for raw sugar, etc. If you're counting on nutrients from any of these, you have to eat so much of them that you're eating too much sugar.
Dr. Galloway, didn't Christopher Columbus bring sugar cane to the Americas?
That's right. Sugar cane is not indigenous to the Americas. It originated probably in New Guinea and gradually worked its way through to Europe. It was cultivated around the Mediterranean in medieval times. The Portuguese took it to their island of Madeira, the Spanish to the Canaries. And Christopher Columbus, I think I'm right in saying the son-in-law of a sugar planter in Madeira, he knew all about sugar.
So it was the family business.
Well, he knew all about it. So when he got to the West Indies, he recognized this was a place where sugar would grow very nicely. And he brought sugar cane on his second voyage to the West Indies.
And this plays a major role in the history of slavery, doesn't it?
It does. The sugar industry used to be very much a luxury product, but once the Europeans got to the Caribbean, it could be grown on a much larger scale than in Europe, but it needed a labor force. And one of the consequences of the European discovery of the Americas was the introduction of a whole variety of old world diseases, which really greatly reduced the population of the indigenous population of the Americas. They had no resistance to these diseases. And essentially in the Caribbean, the indigenous population disappeared altogether, using a bit of a euphemism there. And a labor force was needed, and so the Europeans introduced African slaves. I mean, slavery was not a new institution. It was used, as in Madeira. It was present around the Mediterranean. But it was on a much larger scale in the West Indies.
We're talking about at least 1 million people brought to Jamaica and Barbados.
Well, that's probably too much for those two islands. There's a great discussion as to how many people were actually brought across from Africa in the slave trade, which lasted until into the 19th century. And there's enormous discussion about the numbers. It's very difficult to get at it because often the slave trade was illegal and obviously no records are there. But 10 million possibly over the period, maybe even more than that. I mean, it's a subject of much discussion.
Dr. Cubis, you said that we're not going to get iron or any other essential nutrients from sugar. Do we get anything positive from it?
It seems to make us very happy. But it
and buzzy
really...
in some cases.
I'm sorry?
And also buzzy.
Yes. It isn't an essential nutrient in the classical sense. I mean, before we were able to harvest sugar, we survived. So the body can make glucose, which really is what it needs for the brain and for many of the energy purposes of the body. The body can make glucose from other sources other than purified sugar. So it's not classically considered an essential nutrient. It's a beneficial nutrient. We do get energy. And I think in some ways we have to distinguish between the getting sugar in a modest amount that could have some very positive effects. It has, as Dr. Galloway mentioned, positive preservative effects, et cetera, and our situation now where we're just getting too much.
Well, beets are a good vegetable. Is the sugar obtained from beets substantially different from the sugar that's derived from cane?
The sugar beet, no. Pure sugar from sugar beet and pure sugar from sugar cane are pure sucrose. They're indistinguishable. There are gains, and people who argue that, you know, one source of sugar is better for baking and that sort of thing. But basically, if it's pure sugar, it's the same. You can't tell the difference.
And the big difference is where you can grow them?
That's right. And sugar beet is, sugar cane is a very old crop. Sugar beet is a very new one. The Germans actually begin to experiment with it in the 1800s. It got a big boost in the very early 19th century when Napoleon was ruling most of Europe, and the British were able to blockade continental Europe and stop Napoleon from importing sugar from his colonies in the West Indies. So Napoleon started to encourage sugar beet production. At the end of the Napoleonic era, sugar beet production disappeared again, sugar cane took over. But in the mid-19th century, many countries in Central Europe, which did not have colonies, tropical colonies, places like Germany, Austria, Hungary, Russia, began cultivating sugar beet and making sugar from the sugar beet. And so we get a big growth in the sugar beet industry in temperate countries.
The United States, or do we grow both?
United States grows sugar cane. It also grows sugar beet. And yes, it's got an interest in both.
Now, Dr. Cubis, about how much sugar does the average American consume over the course of a day?
Well, the estimates range from about 20 to almost 50 teaspoons. We should be getting no more than 10 teaspoons of now added sugar. I mean, there's sugar in fruit, there's sugar that naturally occurs in a lot of foods, but the most trouble we get into is with this added sugar. And lots of people, before they leave the house, have already eaten twice as much of the added sugar. If they have a low-fat yogurt, a honey bun, something like that, they've eaten their 10 teaspoons already. Then if they have even a 12-ounce soda, which most people now have 20-ounce sodas, but if they have one 12-ounce soda, that's over 10 teaspoons of sugar. They've used up their whole day's worth of what they should be getting as added sugar.
Well, we know that there are sugars in those things. Do we also get sugars inadvertently?
We get sugars at this point.
When I put jam on my piece of bread, am I getting sugar?
Oh, yes, from the jam, absolutely. That's what makes it so sweet. But when you put ketchup on your pasta, you're also getting sugar. When you have, if you eat, even pork and beans now has added sugar. So there's sugar that's infused in so many different places in the food supply, and that's one of the challenges.
Well, what happens when we take in more sugar than our bodies can use?
If we take in more sugar, but we're not taking in too many calories, then we use the sugar as energy.
But and our body breaks down the carbohydrates into what? Into
carbon dioxide and water.
Mm-hmm.
And your brain needs sugar in the short term. If your glucose level in your body goes low, it's almost the equivalent of having too little oxygen or too little water. That's how you feel. Your brain, on a minute-to-minute level, needs there to be glucose. But our problem is that we're getting much too much, and it's not just too much sugar, it's too much sugar. The things we find sugar in, also we tend to find fat in, et cetera. And the sugar in, let's say, a soda, all we're getting there is calories and no nutrients, so it's considered empty calories.
And that's what makes us fat.
If we get too many calories, the sugar just goes directly and is made, converted from the carbohydrate into fat, and we can store huge amounts of fat. I mean, that's what's got it. That is what got us here. The genes that enable us to store the sugar as fat. Some sugar goes into our muscles and gets stored as glycogen, so that if we need to mobilize something very quickly, utilize fuel very quickly, it's right there and we can break it down quickly. I think it was a 2,000-year-old man was asked, "What's the main mode of transportation?" And the answer was fear. When we have that fight or flight reaction, we're very quickly mobilizing glucose and utilizing it. We can't wait to get to the store.
And that's why when people start to feel like they're flagging, one of the things they may do is take something that has sugar in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a short-term effect, you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a deal with the devil. You at that moment, you should be reaching for something with a more complex carbohydrate or a combination of sugar and protein, a whole food, not a soda.
I usually reach for coffee.
You should, right next to your coffee, I suggest you have something like a banana or something, nuts and raisins and seeds, and that will have more staying power.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll be taking listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Dr. Sharon Acabas, Associate Research Scholar and Associate Director of the Columbia University Medical Center Institute of Human Nutrition, and Dr. Jock Galloway, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Geography at the University of Toronto, author of The Sugarcane Industry, an Historical Geography from Its Origins to 1914, which is published by Cambridge University Press. Stay with us.
That a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
We're back with Please Explain, in this case sugar, with Dr. Jock Galloway of the University of Toronto and Dr. Sharon Acabas of the Columbia University Medical Center Institute of Human Nutrition. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, just one more thing. What is the link between sugar and diabetes? Is there a direct link?
So a lot of people try to make a direct link. Most likely the link is that in cultures where we're getting too much sugar, we're also getting too much fat and too little physical activity, and we're getting fat. And as we get fat, the insulin that we have in our bodies doesn't work as well, so the sugar in our blood starts to build up. But in terms of a direct link between sugar alone and diabetes, that's been very hard to prove.
Let's take some calls. Jim from Union City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm glad to have this topic. And the earlier mention of glycogen, I had tried to stop tea with caffeine. That seems to be my primary source of sugar. And I was, aside from the initial headache from withdrawal from caffeine, then I subsequently had this tremendous body ache as if I had run a marathon. And I was under the impression that glycogen is, as you had said, a carbohydrate that's stored in the muscle. That's when you are running, that's the initial source of fuel, and then the body turns to the fat sources. But could you explain about glycogen a little bit more? And also, just in addictions, it seems people with various addictions, when they stop, they have a sugar craving.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, those are two very important and different questions. With the glycogen, that's the storage form of sugar. And again, that's really important. We have some stored in our liver, some stored in our muscle. That's an immediate source. And sometimes people, when they go on an Atkins-type diet, they say they're very fatigued when they exercise, and they're probably not getting enough glucose in to replete their glycogen. So it's important. It's an important storage form, but it's finite. And when we have filled our glycogen stores, any extra calories from sugar, we start depositing as fat. The addiction question is a very, very interesting one, and I think probably underappreciated. And there are animal studies, for instance, that show during withdrawal from things like cocaine or heroin addiction, if you feed the animal a glucose solution, the symptoms of the withdrawal are reduced. But when people say they feel like they're sugar addicts, that has been much more difficult to prove. And what I end up saying to someone who's in that situation is, if you believe that that's the case for you, there's very little downside from reducing sugar in the diet. That's a sort of a general response I have to most questions related to sugar, that even though we can't prove some of these links, there's very, very little downside. If you ask yourself, is this helping me? And the answer is no.
Well, what about those people who say they're hypoglycemic and need a little bit of sugar, otherwise they'll faint?
Well, even in those cases, the recommendation is not to get it as pure sugar, especially if they're hypoglycemic, because it may have a rebound effect. So you'd recommend a whole food with a combination of some carbohydrate and some protein.
Before we go to another call, I wanted to talk about sugar as a commodity. Dr. Galloway, is Brazil the largest producer of sugar?
Brazil at present is the largest producer of sugar by far, and it's also the largest exporter of sugar.
But I've heard news reports that say that when international sugar prices are low, Brazil just simply uses it as automobile fuel.
Yes, it converts. It's got that choice. If sugar prices are high, it exports sugar. If sugar prices are low, it makes ethanol out of the sugar cane and exports the ethanol.
And is this a very efficient thing? Because in this country, we've been using corn.
Well, I think I'm right in saying that sugar is a far better source of ethanol than corn.
Although corn is now supplying us with a lot of our sugar, isn't it? Most of the soft drinks that have sugar in them are really using corn fructose.
Well, they're using what is called high fructose corn syrup, which is made from corn. And it's a liquid. I think it's very difficult to crystallize high fructose corn syrup. But it's a rather expensive thing to do. You have to understand, in the United States, the sugar industry is very heavily protected. You aren't allowed to sell sugar in the United States below a certain price, which is well above the world price for sugar. And so it becomes possible to make high fructose corn syrup, which is used very heavily in the soft drinks industry. What occurs to me, and I'm not quite sure how it's going to work out, is given the recent buzz about using ethanol in cars and using ethanol made from corn, how this is going to affect the high fructose corn syrup business. If the price of corn goes up because of the new demands being made of it, I'm not sure how it's going to affect the, as I said, high fructose corn syrup business. High fructose corn syrup is very seldom used other than in the United States.
And Dr. Acabas, when I went to Mexico once and had a Coke, which had sugar and not high fructose corn syrup in it, the difference became immediately apparent to me. It reminded me of what Coke had tasted like many years ago. So not all sugars taste the same?
I think you must have a very discerning palate. Most people, I don't know, Dr. Galloway, do you think most people would be able to taste, most people would not really be able to detect that difference. Much is made about not necessarily the taste effects of high fructose corn syrup, but the health effects. And I think here again, the issue is that once it became so inexpensive and so widely available, it's just all over the place. Ted Van Ilyesen once said, "We used to hunt for our food, now food hunts us." And I think if you substitute the idea of a carbohydrate source in there, you'd get the same thing. So high fructose corn syrup in and of itself, again, there's a lot of disagreement about this, but overall the general impression is that it's the amounts that we're getting, not its unique effects compared with sucrose.
My guests on today's Please Explain are Dr. Sharon Acabas and Dr. Jock Galloway. Our number 212-433-9692. Vince from Passaic Park. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Sugar is actually an addictive poison, and consequently, I try my best to keep it out of my household, especially given that my father has mild dementia. The only sugar substitute that's reasonably healthy is called maltitol, but my question has to do with the fact that if you look on the back of a package of a food item with maltitol, while it'll list the quantity of sugar as zero, it does list something called sugar alcohol.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and there's usually a quantity of sugar alcohol. My question is, what is sugar alcohol? Is that harmful? And specifically, does that cause the kind of surge in blood sugar that's associated with, let's say, a pre-diabetic condition and other harmful effects?
Okay, so not to challenge your first statement that it's a poison and addictive, there's a lot of disagreement about that. I think that we're in complete agreement that we're just getting too much of it. Whether or not it's a poison or addictive is a strong statement. The maltitol, the sugar alcohol, is just a slightly modified sugar. These sugar alcohols you absorb a little bit differently, and in someone who's in good glucose control, you actually treat it quite similarly to sugar. You use it as an energy source. The problem you run into is if you're not in good glucose control, then any of these things, sugar alcohols, fructose, any of these other substitutes, not the non-caloric ones, they can be turned back into blood glucose and increase your blood glucose. Chances are you're eating very little of it, and it's not a problem. But when we run into problems when someone, let's say with diabetes, reads a label and sees sugar-free, that means sucrose-free. It doesn't mean it's free of some of these sugar alcohols. So when people chew gum, for instance, and they chew a gum with a xylitol, which is a sugar alcohol, it's a little better for the teeth, but they're still getting around 100 calories if they chew 10 pieces of gum a day.
Is it better for diabetics, a listener asks, xylitol?
So it goes along the same reasoning. If the person with diabetes is in good glucose control, then it's not necessarily better or worse for the teeth. Xylitol is shown to be better. When a lot of people with diabetes use fructose because you can use less fructose and achieve the same level of sweetness. But if they're not in great control, all of these things will worsen their blood glucose the same as sucrose would.
We are now going to Patrick from New York. Hi, Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, I was feeling a little hypo-WNYC-nic, so I had to call in. One interesting thing is, you know, sometimes one feels hungry or tired, and eat something which is sweet, or maybe even pasta, you feel a rush of energy. But it seems that doesn't really is not a consequence of a long process of digestion and production of actual energy. So what is this, some sort of illusion of energy, false?
You're asking if it goes into our bloodstream quicker than other things we eat?
It just seems the feeling of energy and restoration is much quicker than the actual process.
Kind of like alcohol.
The way I interpret that is we have a lot of positive associations with sugar. We think that it's going to make us feel more energy. That'd be a very interesting experiment to do, whether people feel more energetic when you give them something other than sugar, but they think they're getting sugar. So one of the things we haven't focused on is all of the emotional aspects of sugar and the positive associations we have with it. And I think those are wonderful things, but the issue, again, I hate to say this, it's moderation.
Well, let me ask Dr. Galloway about the impact of artificial sweeteners on the market of sugar, sugar as a commodity. Has it made a dent, or do people just have more sweet things nowadays?
I don't know what you necessarily mean by artificial sweeteners. High fructose corn syrup has made a dent in the United States.
I'm talking about the other things like the saccharins and all the other substitutes.
My understanding is that they have made they're a very small part of the sugar market, the sweetener market.
But a very
small percentage of the sweetener market.
It hasn't the consumption of those has gone up, and the consumption of sugar has gone up. It hasn't topped off. It hasn't had a big impact either on our sugar consumption or our weight.
We have Steve from Manhattan with a follow-up to that, I think. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I wanted to ask, I have a bakery, and in the past year or so, there was a big price spike in sugar, and the word that I got was that it was because of Hurricane Katrina. Was that true? Is that the reason why, and is that where we refine most of our sugar in this country?
I don't think Hurricane Katrina would have been all that important. Hurricane Katrina crossed the Caribbean into Louisiana. The Caribbean is now a very minor supplier of sugar from sugar cane, and Louisiana is not all that important either, so I don't think the damage to the sugar industry in those parts of Hurricane Katrina would have been really responsible for the spike in the price of sugar.
Well, are there refineries down there that might have been affected?
Yes, but also the supply of sugar. If there's been poor harvests in major sugar exporting countries like Brazil or Australia or Thailand, which are major sugar exporters, if for some reason there's been a poor harvest there, that might lead to a rise in the price of sugar. The price of sugar does fluctuate on the international sugar markets quite considerably.
Well, Cuba used to be a major supplier, although we can't buy anything from Cuba in this country, but have they cut back a lot?
Well, Cuba used to be a major supplier, about 10 million tons a year. It's now down to about a fifth of what it used to produce in the times when it had the link with the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was basically buying up Cuban sugar. It's now a comparatively minor producer of sugar. The Caribbean generally has, which, in historic times, was a major supplier of sugar. It's now a very, very minor supplier of sugar on the world scene.
I just wanted to add something that a listener sent in. It seems that sugar does come from the Sanskrit word sakara for pebble, and I'm assuming that when the refining process occurred first, it made little pebbles. Later, we came up with the loaves. My guests have been Dr. Jock Galloway, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Geography and University at the University of Toronto, author of The Sugarcane Industry from Cambridge University Press, and Dr. Sharon Acabas of the Columbia University Medical Center Institute of Human Nutrition. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you also.
On Monday's show, we'll take a look at the life of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and then the true story of a terrible farm accident and the revolutionary medical care it inspired. Plus, Lebanese author Elias Koury on his epic novel of Palestinian life, and David Talbot delves into how JFK and RFK's relationship as brothers shaped history. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on wnyc.org, and you can also post comments and email links to your friends. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Bridget Bergen, Samantha Morgan-Stern, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Debbie Dartu is at the audio controls, and I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.